For the last 14 years, Jeff has been designing wireless networks for service providers around the globe with a primary focus on point-to-point and point-to-multipoint networks. He has recently been working with broadcasters to provide the most reliable IP STL solutions. Jeff is currently designing, supplying, and installing wireless solutions for rural LECs, public utilities, and the broadcast industry. His department heads up mission-critical deployments, which require the most reliable solutions in the market. Ladies and gentlemen, a devastated Carolina Panthers fan, Jeff Holdenrid, Double Radius.
Go ahead, give it to him.
Thank you. That was a very hurtful loss, but you guys killed us, so good, hats off to y'all. Like you said, for the last 14 years, I've been designing IP microwave solutions. You all are professionals at RF, you know, no doubt about that. But IP has been something that's been creeping in over the last few years, and that's kind of what we're going to get in today, the change and add to IP. Basically, everything that you purchase today for your studio has an Ethernet connection on it. Same with your transmitter site. So why not bridge the gap and connect the two with an IP solution also? Real quick, how many of y'all are actually deploying licensed or unlicensed IP solutions today? All right, good show of hands there. Okay. Real quick, I want to ask you something before I get started. A lot of y'all have hopefully either sat through my presentations at NAB, seen my webinars. The IP microwave world, from what the presentations that we've done over the last few years have not changed much, but there are some new key things we've added in here for your education. Is there anything in particular on the top of your head right now that you want to make sure that I go over today? Yes, sir. Okay. All right. If there's any competent people in here, please raise your hand. Yes, sir. Okay. So we'll definitely get into that. I'll get into that here in a few minutes or towards the later tail end of this. So any other key things about IP microwave? Yes, sir. Oh, good luck with that. We will be going over that too. There are some things you can do that we will cover in this today. But last but not least, any other key pieces? Okay. Well, let's jump right in. Please stop me. We will do questions at the end, but if there's something in particular right at that moment you need to get out, please go ahead and throw the touchdown pass and give me the question, okay? So first of all, let's talk about the difference between line of sight, near line of sight, and non-line of sight. You would be surprised how many times we design systems for clients and they say, I've got line of sight, no problem. We get up there to put it up, and they don't have line of sight. So the true definition in an unlicensed and licensed point-to-point microwave world, line of sight is 100% clearance of Fresnel zone. There is zero infraction on the Fresnel Fresnel zone, however you want to say it. There is zero infraction whatsoever. So depending on what frequency you deploy, depends on how big that Fresnel zone is, and you have to make sure that you clear it 100%. Now, thanks for this lovely, you know, marketing slide that says up to 155 miles. If anybody wants to give that a whirl, let me know, okay? I will not be signing off on that one, okay? But we have seen successful personally, not in the broadcast world, but in commercial world. I have personally deployed links at 50, 55, and close to 60 miles. I would never do that in what I call broadcast reliability, but we can do those distances. Near line of sight is considered anything less than 50% Fresnel zone fraction. So you can still see the other side, but your Fresnel zone is infracted, you know, 49% or less. This, as you can see, based on the distance change here, 155 miles down to 25, big change in difference. Now, if you're running a licensed frequency, the FCC requires you to have line of sight, not near line of sight. And then last but not least, non-line of sight. We do have solutions out there that can provide reliable IP throughput at non-line of sight. You're not going to get high throughput. You're not going to run uncompressed on it. But we do have solutions that work. And as you can see, anything 50% or more is what we consider non-line of sight. So, like I mentioned, everything is going IP. So how do we get better connections? You know, a lot of people today are using the practices of your public internet, you know, to provide your IP connection. The downside to that is, as we all know at our homes and businesses, that DSL and cable, you are not their number one priority. So if something happens or fails, it could be 10 minutes, an hour, could be 2 days, could be a week before they get you up and running. So we stand behind owning your network and using a microwave system, dark fiber, is a good way to own your network because you control how fast it's fixed, you control the importance of it, the whole nine, it's yours. 950 underbill, this is the first thing we're going to talk about. This presentation is going to cover both solutions for radio and TV. I call this an underbill because we're using a 902 to 928, which is below the frequency of 950, and we're piggybacking it on your existing 950s. So we have a diplexer that merges the 902 to 928 unlicensed frequency into your 950. The solution that I recommend, there are tons of 900 megahertz radios out there. The one I recommend is a 3.5 meg max, and the reason why I recommend it is because it has the best C-to-I ratio of any other product in the market. It also has a 4-watt output power, which allows you to handle the 2 dB hit you're going to get on the diplexer and the line loss up to the top of the tower. So this solution is mounted inside the studio, mounted inside the doghouse at the transmitter site, and then nothing is put on the tower. Your cable and your antennas do not care about that slight difference in frequency from 950 to 902 to 928. So with the 3.5 meg solution, you can set it at a 50-50. It is a shared solution, so you can set it at a 50-50, an 80-20, and at an 80-20, you get 2.7 megs from the studio to transmitter site, which gives you 800K back. It's enough to carry a single channel of audio, have some LAN traffic, also do, you know, report back or remote control and things like that. We've deployed this solution probably at about 50 markets or 50, you know, STLs right now. We have proven it at over 28 miles, running full 3.5 meg speeds. So this is an unlicensed solution that can be dropped in. And here's pictures real quick. So we have our 900 megahertz radio on your left and the diplexer on the right. Unlicensed microwave. Unlicensed microwave has become very popular over the last few years. Not to confuse with the company Ibiquity, but the company Ubiquity has been taking, you know, basically the world by storm when it comes to unlicensed microwave with their low-cost products. In the microwave world, there are two things. Well, there's one thing we can't control, and that's lightning. The other thing we can't control is interference, and by going to a licensed solution, you can. Unlicensed is exactly what it is. It is unlicensed. Anyone can use it. I mean, as long as you follow the rules, but anyone can use it for any reason whatsoever, which means you could put up a link today and have a pretty noise floor, everything's humming along great, and overnight, some wireless internet service provider could put up another link right in front of you on your channel and knock you off the air. So I ask you to tread lightly with 5.8. It's just, if you just want LAN traffic, it works all day long. The question I want you to ask yourselves is when you're running, you know, when you're running your FM, your AM, your TV, the amount of money you're bringing in for marketing dollars and things like that, do you really want that running on a $100 radio? How much confidence do you have in a $100 radio for that solution? Does it work? Yes. I'm not going to tell you it doesn't. I just ask you to tread lightly, plan ahead, and be careful. All the unlicensed solutions today are half duplex, which means if they advertise 100 megs, it's 50-50, 75-25, however you set them. The full duplex solutions are licensed. There are some new products coming out today that run two radios inside the 5.8, which is actually acting as a full duplex. We are going to be doing some testing in the next few weeks on them to prove if they truly are full duplex. We are going to run uncompressed audio across them, see how they handle multicast traffic, and make sure that that actually works in a full duplex, you know, kind of environment. So here's some of the pictures of the Ubiquiti solutions. As you can see, the unlicensed frequencies don't pay attention to the 10 gig, but you have 5, 3, 2, 4, and 900. A lot of people say 3. No, that's licensed. Actually, the 365 band is unlicensed. Do you have to get a license to use it? Yes. Is it policed? No. So basically, you're paying for a database. They're not going to police it. They're not going to tell somebody else not to use it. And so be careful with that kind of loose definition of 365. One quick thing, a lot of people come to me and say, I'm in the middle of nowhere. There's no way there's noise in the area. There are 7,000 wireless internet service providers in the United States. I know that because we work with 85% of them. They are using 5.8, 2.4, 3.65, and 900 megahertz to bring internet access to homes and businesses in rural America, and the noise floor is actually worse in rural America than it is in your cities. So be careful with that. Plan ahead. Use your low-cost radios to do frequency scans, see where your noise floors are, and that will help out a lot moving forward. One thing I want to show you, if you do want to spend some extra money, Cambium Networks has the PTP 650 series, which was recently released. A few years ago, you might know this company. They were known as Orthogon Systems. Orthogon Systems was bought by Motorola, and it was rolled into the Canopy line. Motorola sold off the broadband division, and now it's known as Cambium Networks. So this is the latest and greatest Orthogon Systems radio. Now, if you want to get away from 5.8 interference, this is the way you do it. Cambium has what I call interference mitigation. It actually scans the frequency. It sees what's going on. You see it. I'll show you here in a few slides. You set the threshold, and if somebody puts something up in your way, it knows where a better channel is, and it seamlessly jumps to that channel. So it gets away from the interference that's put up in your area. Now, they are working on something new that I think is really going to set them apart, is the ability to break up a channel. So if you're doing a 20 megahertz channel and you can't find enough noise floor 20 megahertz wide, they're working on a solution that's going to allow them to go 10 megahertz in one channel and another 10 megahertz in another channel, so that you can actually spread your channels apart and it rebuilds it on both sides. So that could be huge for them moving forward. Now, you are going to pay a premium for this. The cost on the Ubiquiti radios is a few hundred dollars, $100, depending on which model you go with. On the Cambium, you're going to pay $2,500, $2,800 a side. And that's just kind of the cost you get behind that. Now, Cambium also runs in a dual polarity. So it's running vertical and horizontal at the same time, just like most of the Ubiquiti products. So this is kind of what I call the Cadillac. Real quick, we just had a client. They were running Exalt radios, the 5.8 Exalt radios, and they were getting killed in noise floor. And they said, Jeff, we want to stay on license. What do we do? I told them to put this up. They put it up, and I finally got a chance to see what the noise floor was like. And across their whole band was sitting at a neg 68, neg 72, neg 73. So we put this up. It's 125 megs out of the box. We dropped it down to a 15 megahertz channel. They've got 6.9s of reliability, running 18 megs in both directions. Now, this radio software upgradable to 450 megs, so they can actually triple that throughput by doing the upgrade. It's still not what it's advertised, but they have a 6.9 reliable link running 18 megs, and there's a lot we can do with 18 megs today. So it's just something to think about there in the unlicensed world. So here's what I was referring to with the frequency scan. As you can see, this is a major exaggeration of a clean and not clean frequencies. you know, the yellow obviously showing neg 40 noise floors, and the blues are showing neg 90s. But this gives you the entire band on both sides, so you can see what's going on. And it's a great planning tool for that. This is a picture real quick of redundancy. One of my clients sent me this, and what they're doing is in the grid dish is obviously their 950. They've done a underbuild and put the 902 to 928 in there, and then below it they've put a Ubiquiti 5.8. So their 950 is redundant on the 5.8 and 902-928, and also their IP is redundant in the 5.8 and the 902-928. So they kind of have RF and IP redundancy on the system, and it's working very well. Now my favorite part, and this is the license gear. I want to get into the license products and some of the solutions we can do with them. This is how you get away from interference. And to be honest with you, price points are coming down so much in licensed products that there are products out today that you can do 100 megs full duplex and your out-of-box cost with antennas, cables, and everything is under $10,000. So when you look at that kind of cost there, depending on what you're paying for lease lines, we're seeing a lot of 14 to 18 month return on investment to run a system that you own and it's licensed. So real quick, back in 2011, the FCC abolished the last link rule, and the last link rule stated that broadcasters could not use Part 101 as a last step from the studio to transmitter site. That was abolished, and now Part 101 is open. It is bidirectional. It's a full duplex. So whatever you have going out is also coming back. If you have 100 megs, you have 100 megs out, 100 megs back. Reliability. To be honest with you, it is mission critical. We can do whatever reliability you want. The key factor there is I don't care how good a product is, it's only as good as the people that engineer it. So do your diligence on who's doing your path calcs. If you don't like doing your path calcs on your own and you call the manufacturer knows two types of reliability, commercial and carrier. Well, we've learned that there's a third one, it's called broadcast. So, you know, at a commercial or carrier grade, you might have 5.9s reliability, but you might still have 10 minutes of outage over the year. That doesn't cut it. So there's a lot of things when you design these things to make sure that they stay up 3 to 5 seconds a year downtime, 7 seconds a year downtime, and that's all in the design phase. That has nothing to do with the actual implementation. As you can see, we got speeds of greater than 1 gig. We have a new manufacturer we're working with, Saragon. They can actually do 1 gig on a single chassis. So if you need a gig, which if you're running HD uncompressed video, we can do a gig for you. But we can also double it up and actually go as fast as 2.4 gig or as slow as 10 megs. So you have a wide range of whatever you need and room to grow. The frequencies in Part 101 are pretty simple. You have 23 and 18, 11 and 6. Anybody here deploying anything over 2 miles, don't look at the upper half of this because there's no reason to deploy 18 and 23 over 2 miles. Yes, sir? 3 miles, do 11 gig. So the FCC has changed the rules over the last few years, and basically anything under 2 miles, you don't have a choice. You can't do 11 or 6, but you can do 18 and 23. Now, anything over 10 gigahertz is going to have rain fade, so you need a plan for that. From the 2 miles to 5, 6 miles, 11 gig is a good solution. You can go as far as 15, 18 miles with 11 gig. We have done it. We've actually done 25, and the only reason why we did that was because it was in D.C., and we could not get a 6-gig band. But we still have the reliability. We have 40 dB of fade built in on both sides, so it works flawlessly. So 11 and 6 are built for your longer distances, and that's where, you know, that's where you get the reliability in them. Any chance you can go 6, go 6. Under 10 miles, 6 gig, you have to turn the power down. But it's still more reliable because it doesn't have the same rain fade as 11. Your deployment options are where you basically get your budget out of. We can do an all-indoor solution, which is the most protected. Basically, it's a 4U chassis, 100% indoors. We run dehydrators and elliptical waveguide up to the antennas, and it is pricey. It costs money. But it is a protection that you don't have to worry about electronics on the tower. The opposite of that is all outdoor. 100% of the electronics are coupled to the back of the dish. Now, with that, you have options. We can run power over Ethernet. We can run hardwired DC and run fiber with it to keep Ethernet off the tower. And then the split solution is where you have electronics on both the ground and in the air, and you run heliax. So we run a half-inch cable. We can run half-inch up to about 800 feet. And then after that, we go to, 5/8, 3/4, and we can go 1,600 feet plus between the two radios. I prefer the split solution just because I'm not a fan of Ethernet on a tower, especially with FM broadcast. FM broadcast, well, the thing is that Ethernet transmits data at 100 megahertz. So how close is that to an FM station? People put up a radio and they say it's not working. No, the radio's working fine. It's the Ethernet cable that's broken, So to alleviate that, if you ground the cable every 25, 50 feet, it usually bleeds out that interference and it'll work fine. But it works so much better with coax or with heliax because it's less susceptible to surge and you don't have to worry about that interference from FM. So here's some quick diag drawings. You can see you have the radio. This is an all-outdoor radio on the tower. We have our grounding, our surge protection. We're running Ethernet down. We're grounding the Ethernet all the way into the lightning protection unit and the power supply. And the power supply is where you have your Ethernet and fiber connections to do your data across the link. In this one here, we have a split system. So in this area, the CMU right here, that's your connections, that's your Ethernet, your fiber, your TDM, your ASIs. That would all be into a half-U or 1U chassis here. We run the heliax up the tower to the outdoor unit, which couples to the back of the dish. And then we have our high-costing all-indoor solution, where we have our chassis, we have our dehydrator, and we have our elliptical waveguide up the tower. Now, to give you an idea, the all indoor solutions, depending on your manufacturer, your throughputs, and everything else, those can run anywhere between $30,000, $50,000, $60,000 a piece, depending on how you want to go. Your all indoor solutions can run you as low as $7,000 to $10,000, or your all outdoor, sorry, $7,000 to $10,000, and your splits can run anywhere between 8 and 20, depending on how you need it done with antennas and cable lengths and things like that. So it kind of just gives you a ballpark figure on where you're looking with each one of these solutions. Some pictures here of some of the radios. In the upper left-hand corner, you have the all-indoor 4U chassis. Next to it is one of the split systems, where you have a small half-U chassis that runs the heliax, runs the superflex or heliax or coax up the tower. At the bottom, you have a modular chassis that allows you to do TDM, allows you to do IP, all in the same chassis, dual redundant power supplies, things like that. And in the upper right-hand corner, you have an all-outdoor system. As you see, this is the Dragon Wave. Some of the all-outdoor solutions are Dragon Wave, SAF, Saragon. They all have all-outdoor solutions. So adaptive modulation is key. I've seen a lot of people licensing links lately at 32 QAM and only 32 QAM. And I'm trying to figure out why, unless the manufacturer they've chosen doesn't do adaptive modulation. So any radio that does not do adaptive modulation is like a light switch. It's either on or it's off. There's no room for anything. It's on or off. If it doesn't meet the threshold because of weather, it's off. So that doesn't really help everybody. Adaptive modulation allows a radio to slow down in speed and either increase receive sensitivity or increase power to gain fade margin and stay up and running. And we're going to show you some examples of that here in a second. So this is basically what I just said, so we'll just go ahead and skip this one. So here's an example of adaptive modulation. As you can see at the very bottom, there are radios today that operate in 2048 modulation. Most radios are, I believe I'm on the right one, I can barely see, but 256 is the norm. So 256 down to QPSK. A couple years ago, you couldn't go below 32 QAM. Now the FCC has changed that rule and allowed you to go to QPSK. So if any of you have license links up and running today that are part 101 and they floor out at 32 QAM, you need to amend your license and get it done to QPSK, and you'll increase that much more fade margin for your link. So just a little note on that one. But as you can see, these are different channel sizes. You know, 6 gig is usually 30 megahertz or 60 megahertz. 11 gig is 40 or 80. 18 and 23 are usually 56. So this shows you speeds, and these are throughput speeds on the link. So as you go lower in modulation, your speed drops, which is okay, because even at a 30 megahertz channel, at 40 megabits, that's a lot of throughput. You can do a lot of stuff with 40 megabits. But what it's doing here, and this is an example of a 256 QAM, so what it's doing here is here you have 19 dB of fade margin. When you drop down to here, you have 52 dB of fade margin, and that's on both sides. That's a lot of fade. That's a lot of weather. That's a lot of question marks covered by adaptive modulation. And this is hitless. You're not going to take an audio blip or a video blip on this. It's hitless. So, well, let me phrase it. It's microseconds. So it's 100 microseconds is the latency, which might be the most you see on your change over here. So this is, in my opinion, the first thing that you need to look at when you're looking at these products and deciding which way to go. Now, the one thing you'll notice also is your IP throughput availability. We have 3 9s here, but we have 6 9s here. And see, as long as the throughput requirement and the 6 9s match up, you should be pretty golden all the time. Now, on a link here, you're looking at roughly, and I'm wondering if I have, no, okay. But you're looking at roughly a 3 second outage per year on that link. No matter what you put up, licensed or unlicensed, you're going to have outage. It's just minimizing that as much as possible. So this is showing here real quick how we are able to do redundancy in licensed links. We have the ability to couple two radios, whether they're all outdoor or split, to the back of one dish. So the only added load to your tower is one extra cable and the ODU, not another antenna. Or we can run spatial diversity or two separate systems altogether and act as redundancy. This one here I wanted to show off real quick for the TV guys. This is a Part 101 licensed backhaul with a indoor chassis. It's got IP and fiber, and this is an ASI box. So it's a 4 programmable ASI box. It carries the ASI native across the system. So it doesn't convert it to IP and convert it back. It carries it native across the link. So whatever throughput is being used by the ASI, you still get what's left over in IP. And it's a quick, easy way for you to do ASI traffic on a licensed link without spending big dollars on, you know, an ASI converter or codec or anything like that. And you get the beauty of both. So I wanted to show this off for you. The licensed products we have, like I said, we can do IP, TDM. So if you have a lot of T1 equipment, we can load that into the wireless, and you still get the IP and TDM at the same time. We also have the ASI. So there's a lot of different options that we can tailor these to the needs of what you have. And that's something that's very important to make sure it works for you. Path profiles and conversions. This is the most important part of my presentation, in my opinion, is how do you get to what do I need and how reliable is it going to be? There are a lot of companies out there that will do these path profiles for you, whether it's your tower crew, your manufacturer, your supplier, myself. So when you design a path profile, there's a lot of tools out there, path loss. There's some free stuff out there. Cambium Networks offers a free tool that implements with Google Earth. It's a great tool. does a lot. I mean, there's more features in there than you and I could use in a year. But it's a great free tool. So when you're designing these systems, this is what I do. This is my rule of thumb when I'm designing them. And if you ever want to send me lats and longs, feel free to email them to me. I'll be glad to run path calcs for you all day long. I probably do 50 to 100 a week. So send them my way. I'd love to. We try to design at 5 to 6 nines reliability. We always do a minimum of 20 dB fade on the highest modulation scheme, which gives us that 40 to 45 to 50 dB of fade at QPSK. And that's where you keep your link up and running. You have to do terrain studies because you have to prove line of sight. You can also, with the Cambium tool, it shows you the K factor, which shows you induction, your reflection off of dew and sun, which helps out a lot with inversion, induction, and things like that. So those are things that you want to take into consideration. Another thing, real quick, is there's two different weather patterns to design a system in, and that's ITU and Vigance-Barnett. Manufacturers usually do it in ITU because it makes them look really good, but a true real-world scenario is closer when you do it with Vigance-Barnett. It is a lot more stringent, so I highly recommend you have your manufacturer, your supplier, or myself run it in Vigance-Barnett, put it up, and have it outperform what we said it would do. Instead of doing ITU and being the vice versa on that. So here's a quick picture of some of the things that you see in the tool, and I know this is really small, but as you can see, you have the terrain study, you can add trees, it shows you the Fresnel zone based on the frequency you're using, you set your heights, you set your antennas, it gives you a link loss. It gives you a lot of information. That thing I showed you earlier with the fade margin and the reliability is all part of this also. So it gives you everything that you need to design a system reliably. One of the key things you can do is you can set in your mean and minimum IP requirements, and you can make sure that you're at the reliability that you want at those speeds. So this kind of takes the guesswork out of what you're doing. This tool, honestly, in the 12 years I've been using this tool, it's really only steered us wrong once, and that was because, well, it was because there was a little miss thing on the Google Earth, and the Google Earth actually had the terrain 100 feet off of what it really was, so the tool was still telling the truth. It was just whatever the terrain that was imported just ended up being wrong, but this is a very powerful tool. It does implement with Google Earth, where you can zoom in and see Fresnel zones. You can see obstructions. You can go street view, see if buildings are hitting your signals, and it is really a powerful tool. If you Google Cambium Link Planner, it'll pull it right up to where you can download it, or you can email me, and I'll be glad to send you a link to it. Here's the other piece. So this is where we're showing again. We're showing the different modulation schemes, we're showing the fade margin on both sides, we're showing the throughputs at each one of the fade margins. This is actually a link that we put up in Las Vegas, Nevada. As you can see, the stratosphere is the midpoint. Yes, sir?
Real quick, back on one slide, last one.
Mm-hmm.
Does that have the
Earth curvature that you factor into that too? Yes, it does. Yes, once you, in the picture, in this picture here, it's not showing the K factor, it's just showing Earth. But when you, this might have been from a real old version. I didn't take a screenshot of a recent one, but it literally has a gray line. So the brown is Earth, green is trees that you want to add or obstructions you want to add, and then there's a gray line that goes across the top that is your K factor. So that system there, real quick, when the city center was built, it knocked out line of sight for the 7 gig link from the studio to transmitter site. So we put in an A to B, B to C with the ASI boxes I showed you, and it's shooting from the studio to the stratosphere and then the stratosphere to the TV transmitter site. And that's been up for, I want to say, about 8 months now, and it's been running great. Another solution here is the 7 gig underbuild. Once again, I call it an underbuild because we're taking 5.8 or 6 gig and diplexing it into a 7 gig signal. So we have a diplexer that in the 5.8, it has two CPR 137s at the top and the bottom. And on the elbow that comes out, it has an end connector that we can diplex a 5.8 directly into it and add IP traffic to a 7 gig system. The other diplexer has three CPR 137s, and we take a small waveguide jumper and we put it into this, and now you have a licensed 6 gig on your 7 gig, which, you know, obviously, even though you're using a 7 gig antenna, you're still producing a 5.8 or 6 gig signal, so it gets you away from interference on that same system. Does that make sense? We do have people successfully doing this with Ubiquiti. Be careful. So just giving you a heads up. We have people that are using bullets and they're using this to do IP traffic. It's working great. But once again, you're still in that 5.8 world. So, you know, always watch out for the interference. Last slide here, just wanted, these are some of the products that we represent. There's a few extra that have come in recently that are not on here. But to give you an idea, so Double Radius, I've been there for 13 years now. We do everything from engineering. We don't charge, like I said, for path calcs. We do the FCC licensing for you. We supply hardware. And if anyone's looking for competent tower crews, you can call us. We have two or three that we use across the country that have deployed hundreds of these systems over the last 3-4 years. So we do know a lot of good people that do good work on tower crews. So we can do as little or as much as you want us to when it comes to IP microwave. A question I get a lot is how long does it take, you know, to do a license link? Our current time frame run rate right now, if you want us to do 100% of the business from engineering to integration, is 90 days from start to finish. And that timeline is based on, it takes approximately 1 to 2 weeks for us to do the PCN paperwork. PCN clears in usually 2 weeks or a month, depending on how you want to do it. Then we're allowed to order equipment. Antennas, depending on their size, can take anywhere between 2 and 8 weeks to be brought in. And then from there, once everything is 100% in-house, we label, configure, ship, and we're on the ground within, you know, a week to 3 weeks to do the install, depending on what our install schedule is like. So I just want to give you that heads up. Based on that, that is what I have for you all today. Do we have any new questions based on what you've seen here? Yes, sir. Oh, the microphone's coming.
Yeah, I had a couple questions. On the full duplex systems, latency both ways pretty good.
Latency?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? The latency?
Yeah, for like audio over IP systems where they have to respond.
On the licensed products, they are 100 microseconds. So you have 100 microsecond latency out and 100 microsecond latency back.
And also I had a question about the split system. Can you do that using the same coax as a 950 system? Or does it have to be a separate coax?
So your 950 is a 75 ohm?
50.
50, and usually we use a 75. Now, it has been proven to work, but I personally have not done it.
Okay.
So I believe so. It's just, it might be, we might have to check distances of the line runs, but there is a good chance that would work okay.
Have you had any systems put in place on AM towers? And if so, what were the AM power levels of those stations if you successfully done these systems?
Okay. AM is not a problem with the split system because we run the IF cable through through an ISO coupler just like you would, you know, on the other. On the underbuild in AM, that's been very huge success because you already have your 950 up and everything's done on the ground. So that's an easy way just to add IP to an AM system. Now, if some of you are familiar with WSB in Atlanta, we are putting in they had a tower next to it that was not hot, and they said, we have line of sight. We got on site. It wasn't line of sight. So now we're having to mount it on their huge WSB. I don't remember exactly. It's hot. I don't want to get near it. So to alleviate that problem, what we are doing, an ISO coupler won't work in that scenario because it's so hot, it's going to arc over. So what we're doing instead is we're taking the lighting and we're powering a powered enclosure, and we're mounting the radios 100% on the tower, and we're fiber across the inductor to get into, or the isolator, to get into the network. The other thing we can do in the Saragon radio, it's 48-volt DC. We can power that right off of the lights, and we can then just run fiber up to it without a problem, and that's an all-outdoor solution without having to actually run a power cable across the ground. I'm sorry, what?
The motherboard hasn't had a problem with RF getting into it?
No. We have not had an issue yet on that aspect. We've deployed the split system on 4 or 5 hot towers, and we haven't had an issue yet.
I was wondering if you found a brand of shielded RJ45 connectors that you like, because there seems to be quite a different flavors out there with some not so good connection to the shielded for PoE Ethernet cables?
Not really on the shielded connector. On the cable, yes. The connectors, we haven't really had a problem with the connectors. We like to stick to a Superior Essex. It's a BBDGE cable. It is literally a outdoor Cat5 cable with a solid copper shield. And then, everything. So it's easy to strip it back to that copper shield and ground it every 25, 50 feet, and that we've had more success with that than anything else. We haven't had any issues installing that on a tower, no matter how hot the FM was or any of that.
How do you address, as I mentioned this at the beginning, how do you address the situation of getting tower climbers properly trained before the job, to get up there and to do the job right? Because this has been a very serious problem around the industry, and we've suffered a lot from that at our company.
The one thing that we've done, and I think it might be, it could answer the question, it could not. First of all, we always use NATE certified tower crews, always. NATE certified. National Association of Tower Erectors. We use NATE certified crews on everything. We always send our own IT techs on site with the tower crews. So we are crimping the ends. We're making sure that they know exactly what they're doing before they get on the tower. And if not, we're doing it on the ground before they get it. The systems that we're putting in, we run a jumper that's usually 8 feet or 6 feet from the radio to a surge protector. And we build that out with the mounts on the ground before they even get in the air. So that part is finished to the point where all they have to do is run cable down the tower to the next surge protector. And it's not hard to drop a line and tie it off or use, however you're hooking it up. So we try to take the I don't want to say dummy work out of it, but we try to make it as dumbed down as possible for starters. We all know tower crew are a different breed. They're good at climbing towers. They're good at that. But we just try to do as much of it on the ground before it ever even gets in the air in the first place. But NATE, I would highly recommend looking at NATE certified crews. They do a great job. Okay. Any more questions? All right. Well, I have 1 minute and 50 seconds to go. No, I'm just kidding. I want to thank all y'all for your time. I hope this was informative for you. I am the broadcast engineer at Double Radius. Feel free to reach out to me, even if you just want to bounce questions off me. We rep 30, 40 different products, and I only position the product that's going to best suit you. So, and if you want to talk to some of the people we've worked with, I have a long list of broadcasters that we've worked with over the last 3 or 4 years. So if you have any questions, concerns, product information, or just bounce ideas off me, feel free to reach out anytime. Thank you.